Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
I want to welcome everybody to the Tire Cover Bookstore, and thank you for coming out and supporting your local and independent businesses, because it really does make a difference in our community. It's hard for me to stop talking about this book. I mean, I've annoyed the people in my life, the booksellers here, about how good this book, this really, really, really good this book is, and I'm so glad that I found it. I'm so glad that I'm here tonight with the author. I guess I would just say this. The best authors, it seems to me, have a way of letting us into worlds that we wouldn't have been able to, we either haven't partaken of, or we just wouldn't be able to get to ourselves. And in many ways, it seems like tonight's author's career has been about that, writing for a number of magazines, both both in newspapers like New York Times and San Francisco Journal, San Francisco Chronicle, Men's Journal, Outside Magazine, which actually was the place where this story began in some ways. There's an article based on some of the No Limits Diving here where this book began. So without further ado, I just want to introduce tonight's author, James Nestor.
Thank you. He kind of summarized the whole presentation right there, so you can all go home. It's all done. So I was the book's been out for about 6 months, so I'm kind of out here by complete happenstance. I was called up a couple months ago by the Vail Symposium, and they asked me to go up there and do this presentation that I was touring with in July and August, all over the place, in West Coast, East Coast, so on and so forth. And I was curious. I was like, well, what are people in a landlocked state going to be so have any interest in ocean, you know, and the human connection to the ocean, free diving and all that? And I realized later, a couple days later, that there are more people per capita in Colorado who scuba dive than anywhere else in the U.S. So more than California, my home state. And more than Florida, which seems insane. So in many ways, this is the most appropriate place in the U.S. for me to be doing this presentation. So this book began as an article, as was said, about 2 years ago. I was sent by Outside Magazine to cover something called the World Freediving Championships. Now, this is a very weird event in which competitors challenge one another to see how deep they can dive on a single breath and come back to the surface conscious. So I had never seen anyone freedive, had certainly never done it myself, didn't know anyone who did it. So I went out to Kalamata, Greece, and the event was held about 6 miles out from the Kalamata Marina. And I remember sitting on this sailboat and watching the first diver come out, and his name was William Troubridge. He took a single breath of air, upturned his body, and dove, and kept sinking and sinking and sinking until he completely disappeared. 4 minutes later, I saw his tiny figure rematerialize in the ocean, and it grew bigger and bigger and bigger till he popped up right next to the sailboat, exhaled, took a breath, and got out of the way for the next competitor. He had just made a dive that was more than 330 feet deep on a single breath of air. So I remember talking to my mom that night, and I said, I just saw the most incredible thing. You won't believe it. This guy dove down 330 feet on a single breath of air. And she said, oh, that's impossible. It's never going to happen. So she said that there must be an air tank down there, and I should do a bunch of research before publishing any of this. That was her quote. So I did my research and found if there was an air tank and if the freedivers would have taken a hit off of it when they were down there, their lungs would have exploded by the time they reached the surface. Only the human body in its natural form can make such a deep dive so quickly. So I got back home to San Francisco, and I started checking out the other amazing human abilities that we've forgotten about. Not only freediving, but things like echolocation, magnetoreception, and these other reflexes and senses we share with oceanic animals, and that human connection to the sea. And so that's what this book turned into, and that's what the rest of the presentation here is about. The second we put our faces into water, something amazing happens. Your heart rate will lower about 25% of its normal resting rate. Blood will start coursing from your extremities into your core. Your mind will enter a very meditative state. Now, the deeper you go, the more profound these reflexes become, until eventually, at very deep depths, you resemble only a passing resemblance to your terrestrial body. The ocean physically changes you. European visitors to Japan and the Caribbean and the South Pacific knew all about these magical amphibious abilities, and they use them to dive down to depths of around 150 feet. And some sailors reported seeing divers stay down there for 15 minutes at a time, which, of course, is impossible. And these sailors went back home to England and Italy, and they said, "We saw these guys dive down for 15 minutes. And all the scientists said, "You guys are ridiculous. You're drinking too much rum. No one can do that." Well, today, free divers are diving down to more than 700 feet, and they're holding their breath for over 12 minutes. The world record breath hold underwater is 12 minutes and 10 seconds. And they've only been doing it for about 15 years. So if we keep going at this rate, we're going to pass the 1,000-foot mark in probably about 5 to 6 years and be able to hold our breath as long as those ancient divers, up to 15 minutes. So how is this possible? How can the body survive in stresses that are 30 times that of the surface? In the water, the deeper we go, the more pressure increases and air contracts. Seawater is about 800 times denser than air, so this pressure increase happens very quickly. A dive down in water 10 feet is equivalent diving down in altitude 10,000 feet. But instead of everything puffing up like it does, like a bag of chips on an airplane or when you drive up to the mountains, everything shrinks down. Everything with air inside it and a flexible surface will shrink down, including human lungs. Human lungs at 33 feet will be at half of their regular volume. At 66 feet, they're going to be at a third of their regular volume. 99 feet at a quarter, and so on and so on. So you can imagine how small they would be at 400 feet. Very, very small. How can we survive this? Partially, it's because we came from the ocean, and we still, all of us, have an ocean within us. The human blood is about has a 98% similar chemical composition to seawater. The amniotic fluid in which a fetus develops is 99% similar to seawater. We grow fins first instead of feet, and are one misfiring gene away from growing fins instead of feet or hands. When we finally make it out, we are born free divers. An infant, when placed into water, will reflexively open her eyes, she'll start breaststroking, and she'll stay down there for about 45 seconds at a time on her own will. This is, of course, not force. No one would do this. They choose to do that. So that's longer than many adults. We only lose that ability when we're taught how to walk. But getting it back, as you will see, is pretty easy. Now, what I'm going to show you here, my computer has just not been behaving, but I have a backup, is a free dive by a guy named Guilherme Neri. Let's all use our conscious energy here and will Apple to make this work. And it looks like it's not going to happen, so I have a backup. I've never had to do this, but we're just going to do it this way. So this is a free dive by a free diver, again, named Guilherme Neri. It's been viewed about 30 million times on YouTube. It's in real time, so if you get really bored listening to me, you can hold your breath along with him and see how long you last. The second he enters the water, his heart rate is going to lower. His mind is going to enter that meditative state. As he struts down to 35 feet, something amazing happens. His buoyancy neutralizes. So the water stops pulling him up to the surface, and it starts pulling him down. And anywhere past this depth, he will be pulled down to the seafloor and will keep getting pulled down until he reaches the bottom. This is something some freedivers call the doorway to the deep. Now, you're going to watch when he hops off. He's not going to paddle his feet. He's not going to move his arms. He's just going to effortlessly float down, and he's going to keep floating down. This is not a video trick. This is what it's like once you get past 40 feet. So at around 150 feet, his lungs are the size of two fists. The way the body combats those pressures is it reflexively starts engorging the lungs with blood to stop them from collapsing. His heart rate will lower to around 14 beats per minute. Now, that's about a third of the rate of someone in a coma. Some freedivers have recorded heart rates as low as 7 beats per minute. So our understanding of human physiology, that's totally impossible. That cannot support consciousness, a heart rate that low. But yet, deep in the ocean, it does, and still no one understands exactly how. So as he approaches around 300 feet, that master switch, all of these amphibious reflexes really start kicking in. His organs start allowing for the free flow of water and plasma into them to stop themselves from crushing. These reflexes only happen in deep water, and each of us has them. We can, if we choose to go down to 300 feet, we would all have these same reflexes. So as he cruises down, his mind is going to start wandering a bit. He's going to sometimes forget where he is. Now comes the really hard part. He's at 300 feet, and he needs to make it back up against that negative buoyancy. But as you can see, he's extremely experienced. He's saved his oxygen reserves. He's French, so he's going to do a little miming for you, do some air guitar. He's going to take his time because he's very experienced. He's done this a zillion times. So as he goes back up, he's pushing against buoyancy. It's like being on the moon. It's almost like a zero gravity state. He can hold on to rocks, pull himself up, choose to kick up, do whatever he wants. The further he goes up, all of those reflexes start reversing themselves. His mind wakes up. His heart starts beating faster. Blood starts coursing back into his limbs. Who's still holding their breath? Because he's still is. So free divers diving under their own ability cannot get the bends. We can't get decompression sickness. That only happens to scuba divers. The body naturally knows how to purge that nitrogen gas. And that's what he's going to do right here. He's going to get rid of all of that stale air. He's going to pop up to the surface, take a breath, and get ready to do it all over again. So those are the mammalian dive reflexes. Let me get this back here. The video will probably play now after all that. Okay, so we are not the only animals born with these amphibious reflexes. Seals, dolphins, and whales also have them. This guy, the Weddell seal, can dive down to 2,500 feet and stay down there for an hour at a time. Researchers who studied these animals found that they actually seem to gain oxygen the deeper they dove, which, again, is impossible. You can't possibly gain oxygen the further away from the surface you are, the further away from your last breath. And yet, these guys don't really care what's possible in our realm of understanding. They've been doing it for like 10,000, 100,000 years, and they do it all the time and come back perfectly safe. So we share more in common with oceanic animals than just the master switch. We also share a number of six senses. In a lightless, cold, and pressurized environment, animals need different senses to communicate, navigate, and see. Humans, too, have these extra senses. And they are all remnants of our collective past in the ocean. They're latent, mostly unused, but like the amphibious dive reflexes we have, they have not gone away, and you can revive them. Now, just a warning, this is going to get really weird really quickly, but I will try to keep it simple and fun for you all. So we've been taught that we all have five senses with which to perceive the world: taste, touch, smell, sight, and hearing. But what good is that in a completely black ocean when you're swimming thousands and thousands of feet down? And what good is that when you have to migrate from one part of the planet to the other and back again every year when you can't see where you're going? How do animals do this? Some researchers believe that animals are using a sense of magnetoreception to home in on the Earth's subtle magnetic field, and they use this energy coming out as a kind of internal GPS to find their way around. I know it sounds pretty crazy to you, but we've already found magnetoreception to exist in bacteria and butterflies and birds. That's how they get around. So it makes pretty good sense that oceanic animals would be using it as well. And one of the most adept animals at using this are sharks. So this is my illustration. This is why I write and don't do graphics, because that's about as good as I could do. So in 2002, some researchers tagged a shark named Nicole with a satellite tag. Now, this satellite tag would trace exactly how deep Nicole swam and what route she was taking around. 100 days later, the tag came off. What they found was amazing. Nicole swam from the tip of South Africa to the western coast of Australia, 7,000 miles in 100 days. Pretty good. But what was even more astounding was the route she took. She swam in almost a perfectly straight line from one point to the other, 7,000 miles. Now, the average depth she was swimming at was about 1,000 feet. Zero light down there, zero landmarks. Even more incredibly, about 6 months later, they were back at the same beach in South Africa. Who did they see? Nicole. And she probably took that same track exactly back. That's the most efficient way, is a straight line from one point to the other. So how is this possible? A lot of researchers think these little dots on the shark's nose have something to do with it. Those are the ampullae of Lorenzini, and they are extremely sensitive to electroreceptive fields, electrical fields. So sharks use these to home in on prey. That's how they hunt. But researchers also believe because they're so sensitive, they're able to home in on the Earth's magnetic field and use that as a kind of internal GPS. Now, great white sharks can home in on about 125 millionths of a volt. These very weird-looking animals, the bonnethead shark, can home in on about 1 billionth of a volt. So it's no coincidence its head is shaped like a radar disc. That's a very efficient form in which to home in on these signals. So just to give you a little perspective on how small of amount of electricity that is, imagine if I was holding a about a volt and a half battery right now and ran 400 miles of wire from here. This shark sense is so sensitive it could feel the magnetic field coming off of that battery 400 miles away. Now, that's 5 million times more sensitive than any human sense, and it's by far the most sensitive sense we've yet discovered on the planet. So, sharks do it, bees do it, butterflies do it, we probably do it too. Ancient sailors were very proficient at sailing around the South Pacific, thousands of miles across the sea, always making it back home. They could use the sun some of the time. They could use the stars some of the time, but they couldn't use these things all of the time, especially when it was cloudy, when they were in storms. These cultures also have something in common with these guys, who had a sort of cardinal sense of direction. They didn't have words for right and left, but they do have words for north, south, east, and west. Their names are the Gugu Yimithir from Australia. If they wanted to make room for you on a sofa, they wouldn't ask you to move to the right. They'd ask you to move west. They don't bend backwards. They bend northwards or southwards. So the only way this culture could communicate with one another was if they knew their exact position on the planet at all times, which is really hard to do at night, and which is impossible to do in an enclosed space. But they did it all the time, and they weren't alone. This culture in Mexico, the Chechel, used those same cardinal directions. Some researchers went out, grabbed one of these guys at night, blindfolded him, put him in a room, spun him around a dozen times, and asked him to point north, south, east, and west very quickly. He did it without hesitation 20 times in a row. And then the researchers just kind of gave up and went home. So I know that sounds really crazy. How can we have this magnetoreceptive sense when most of us can't make it out of a parking lot? The fact of the matter is we just don't need it now, but 400 years ago, it was central to our survival. This is what New York City, what Manhattan, was supposed to look like 400 years ago. You need a pretty good sense of direction to make it home through these heavily forested areas day after day. Here is what Manhattan looks like today. You need zero sense of direction to make your way around. There are landmarks, there are street signs, and at any time, basically anywhere on the planet, you can pull out your phone and dial up your GPS. So just like the need to free dive down to the ocean's floor, hundreds of feet down, and hold your breath for minutes at a time, this sense of magneto reception has probably latent. It's mostly unused, but again, doesn't mean it's gone away. And one thing I'm not going to talk about, because I try to cut this part a little short, is the thousands and thousands of human trials of magneto reception done in the 70s and 80s. They all had the same result. We can do this if we want to. It's as easy as closing your eyes, willing your body to do it, and trusting yourself. And if you want more details on those, I'm happy to give them to you. I'm sure there will be zero people here tonight that will want more information on magneto reception. You all made it. Magneto reception is over. So now comes the fun stuff. Dolphins and whales use a different sense, not a magnetoreceptive sense, something called echolocation. And they use this sense by sending out a click and waiting for the echo of that click to come back. And they use all that data to form a picture of everything around them. It's just like a sonogram. And it works exactly the same as sonar. That's how sonar, what it came from. This little video, which I did not do, shows a sperm whale, who are really good at doing this, how they send out this click, they wait for it to echo off something, they use that information to form a picture. Now, sperm whales are so good at using echolocation, they can spot a human in the water from a mile away. Dolphins are also really good. They can spot a rice grain from 300 feet away. And they can tell the difference between a ping pong and a golf ball from around 300 feet away as well. So in some ways, they're better at seeing their environment with sounds as we are seeing our environment with our eyes. Now, we're pretty good at echolocation. Not as good as that, but we're still pretty good. This guy is, his name is Brian Bushway. Now, he is completely blind. He lost his sight at 14 years old. He's not legally blind. He has zero optic nerves, zero ability to see. But he has taught himself to use this echolocation to click and wait for the echoes of those clicks to come back to him to form a picture of everything around him. He's able to ride his bike down busy city streets. This is not a busy one, but it's still a suburban street. He's able to tell the difference between a golf ball or, a tennis ball and a Rubik's Cube, the table across from you. He camps alone in the wilderness for weeks at a time. So when researchers took him and some other echolocators and put him in an fMRI and looked at their brains as they were clicking, their visual cortexes lit up. So what they were seeing with sounds was that basically the same thing that everyone here is seeing with their eyes. Different frequencies, different sense, but the same end result. Now, again, we're pretty good at echolocation, but we're nowhere near as good as the mighty sperm whale. We can send out clicks at around 80 decibels. This animal is the loudest animal on Earth. It sends out these clicks at 236 decibels. They are so loud that they can make a human deaf in the water, and they can also vibrate us to death. So they are among the most feared predators in the ocean, and definitely the largest. So what I'm going to show you now, I don't have any audio on this, so I'll put the mic up to it, is what it's like to dive with a bunch of clicking sperm whales. And how that feels. This is from about a year and a half ago. Some of the researchers that I spent a long time with studying in the book. And, oh, the video is working. That's very good. So what you're going to hear right now, this is not any sound or noise from a boat. This is what it sounds like to be in the water with sperm whales clicking you. Their clicks are so powerful, they penetrate through flesh, and they can actually see what's inside of you. So this guy is getting really curious with a cameraman, and I'll just sort of let you watch and listen to this for a second. So if this were in real life, that would be like 4,000 times louder. This cameraman, about a half an hour after this, put out his hand to stop a calf from bumping into him, and his hand was paralyzed for about 4 hours because its nose was vibrating so violently. And you see he's still clicking him. They process the echoes of the sound underneath their jaws. They don't use their ears for echolocation. So I know what a lot of you are thinking right now. Why the hell would anyone ever want to do this? As you can see, this animal has, you probably can't see this, but about 8-inch long teeth. Again, it's the largest predator on Earth. You see the size of that diver right there. He could so easily fit into his mouth and his stomach and so on. So it turns out that free diving is not only the best, but basically the only way to study these animals up close. That's why they free dive with them. If you scuba dive with these animals, they get really freaked out and turn the other way. Submarines don't work. Robots don't work. But if you free dive with them, you're completely silent and something amazing happens. Instead of swimming away from you, they turn around and they surround you, and they will stay there as long as you're willing to stay there. We've had these encounters that lasted about 4 hours with sperm whales, and it's like some crazy New Age dream. They orient themselves like obelisks, and they cruise around you and just pepper you from all sides with their echolocation. But something else amazing happens, and this is not some New Age theory. This is scientific stuff here, is they stop sending echolocation clicks once they approach you, and they start sending communication clicks. These are two distinctly different types of clicks used for two distinctly different things. And from what we know, they are possibly trying to identify with us, trying to reach out and contact us in some way. Now, I know that sounds crazy to a lot of people. Again, like, of course, whales can't talk. We're the only animals on Earth that can really have a sophisticated form of communication. But just consider a couple things first. What you're looking at is two sperm whales head on. That big bulbous thing on top is their brain. That brain is 6 times the size of yours. Sperm whales also have neocortex. And now a neocortex in a human is thought to govern functions as conscious thought, future planning, and language. Their neocortex is 6 times the size of ours. Sperm whales also have spindle cells. These are highly developed brain structures that neurologists have associated with feelings of compassion, love, suffering, once again, language, all those things that make humans human and separate us from great apes. Sperm whales not only have spindle cells, but they have them in a far larger profusion than we do, and they've had them for 15 million years longer than we have. Humans have had our current size brain for about 200,000 years. They've had theirs for 50 million years. So what are they doing with this enormous brain? Animals don't randomly grow very large brains. Brains take up a lot of energy. They're using them for something. They're communicating with one another. They could be trying to send out a little signal to us. What are they doing when they orient themselves like this and send these communication clicks back and forth to one another? They do this when humans are in the water as well. And again, this goes on for hours and hours. We found that sperm whales have different dialects depending on where they come in the ocean. This is all documented stuff. So we know they're communicating with one another. We know that they have the ability to have a sophisticated form of communication. We just don't know quite what they're saying yet. I was lucky enough to spend about 18 months with these people doing this freediving research. I was able to freedive with these animals, have these experiences, the same experiences with dolphins and sharks, and to try to understand our human potential and also our relationship with the ocean and these oceanic animals. And in a nutshell, that's what the book is about. Thank you very much for coming out, everybody. Appreciate it. Oh, I think I went on too long. I was trying to speed up a little bit. Yeah. That's all I've got. No, we could do some questions. I bet you have one. No, maybe not. Yes. Yeah, there was a bunch of Navy research, and I get into that a bit in the book, in the 60s to crack the dolphin language. They even set up this enormous institute in the Bahamas specifically dedicated to studying the dolphin language, and it was run by a guy named John C. Lilly, and who was with the National Institute of Health. And depending on who you talk to, some people think that they were absolutely able to crack it, and they had it, and it was covered up, and there's all this weird conspiracy theories around it right now. So we know that dolphins can very easily learn human language. They can't speak it back because they don't have a larynx, but they're able to take commands, and you can mix up words in different ways, and they understand that. But they're very hard to study. Since the 70s, there's been a lot of bans on having captive dolphins and studying them for good reason. And the dolphins in SeaWorld are bred over and over again, so they're not exposed to larger communities of other pods of dolphins. So there is some research being done in dolphin communication, but not a lot, mostly because of all of these regulations. And that's what's so exciting about this group of guys who are now working with the French Navy and the University of Paris. They're freelance, so they don't need anyone's approval. They don't need to wait for a grant. They get a Subway sandwich and a couple of bottles of water. And this guy who took this picture has documented more wild dolphin behavior and communication and sperm whale behavior and communication than anyone else on the planet, freelance guy. So I don't know if that answered your question even slightly. They've used them, but it depends. They are, and they use them for in war. They in the Persian Gulf, they use them to attach bombs to enemy boats. This is all known stuff. And there's a lot of people in San Diego and in Point Magoo who are doing this, but a lot of it's under wraps as far as what specifically they're doing. But they do use them. They deploy them to combat enemies, you know. But as far as communication is concerned, just not a lot of research being done.
What's the current record for freediving? What are they going for?
I was at the last attempt for the current record. He made it down to 830 feet, but he just didn't make it back too well. And that's when I had a big realization that that's not the kind of freediving I support or want to see or want to even hear about anymore. Whenever you hear about freediving, everyone says, yeah, wasn't there a guy in Brooklyn who died about a year ago? It's like, yeah, what about the 30 million other people who are doing this responsibly, who are doing it to research animals and, you know, experience this meditative state? So that's what it's not an official record, 830 feet, because he didn't make it up well, but 700 feet is the official record. But that's what, at the beginning of the book, I was going to profile a lot of competitive diving. I went to the one free diving competition in Greece. It almost turned me off to it completely. A few months later, I went to that thing. I said, that's it. So competitive diving is at the beginning of the book, but there's a big change to using it for more, what I think, more constructive means. So, yes.
Could you talk about your own experience learning to free dive? How did
Sure. So my own experience freediving, I was supposed to repeat these questions before, and I totally blew it. It took me a really, really long time, not physically. Everyone here has the ability, if you're in reasonable health, to hold your breath around 3 minutes. Right now, with about 30 minutes of instruction, you will hold your breath for 3 minutes, without a doubt. So that physical part happens very, very quickly. I surf. I've been in the ocean my whole life. But the mental part, seeing all those faces of people who are unconscious at those competitions, seeing what happened to Herbert Nitsch, the diver who went down to 830 feet. That's what I kept seeing every time I tried to go deep and hold my breath for a long time. So it wasn't until I was hanging out with these guys and seeing these free divers off, you know, the deck of a boat that I thought, I want to have this experience. I want to do it responsibly. I want to do it, you know, for the betterment and understanding of these animals. And once I was able to click that switch, it happened very quickly. The first time I ever tried to hold my breath underwater with someone there watching, I held my breath for 4 minutes. So, and I'm not special. There are other people holding their breath much longer than that. So again, anyone can do this. All those mammalian dive reflexes I was talking about at the beginning, we all have those, and they're only triggered in water. They're there for a reason. They're there to be used. So you can choose to use them or not. But if you choose to, it happens very quickly. Yes. Yes, the master switch is another name that scientists use to explain the mammalian dive reflexes. It's one of the most disarming things I've ever felt, and especially when you get to around 35 to 40 feet, when we're so used to being in a swimming pool and kicking and struggling to get down to the bottom. But when suddenly you realize you're not kicking and you're floating down and you look up at the surface and it's, you know, way up there, four stories up there, it's a very surreal experience, and it requires absolute, like, profound physical and mental meditation. That's why I love it. There's no half-assing it. You got to go all the way, know yourself, listen to your body, and really get in tune with that. And there's, we don't do that too often in our culture. And so it was a really neat thing to learn that. As far as feeling your lungs shrink up, it's just, you do it foot by foot. You know, you don't suddenly try to go down to 100 feet. You go down to 20 feet one day, 21 feet the next, 22 feet. But it is a very weird thing to take a huge breath of air at the surface and be down at around 50 feet and feel your lungs up here. And you couldn't even cough up that air. You don't have enough because it is so compressed. So it's a mental game. And again, if you approach it like a yogic meditation, it's a very different thing. You have to, again, trust yourself and not freak out. So we'll do one more. How about you? How I'm sorry?
Like, how is, if your book has all been used for the efforts for protecting?
Yeah, something that the best thing that came out of this, you know, again, this is the paperback's coming out in about, I'm not trying to plug the paper, I'm trying to answer your question, I swear to God. So how is this book used for animal conservation in the ocean? Paperback's coming out in May, so I rewrote a ton of it because so much is happening right now. And one of the best things that's come out of this book is the main guy I profile, Fabrice Schnoller, who's doing all these amazing whale studies and swims with these animals and is basically creating this new fringe form of scientific research. He's gotten a tremendous amount of attention and funding. So this is kind of what he does full time. He used to do it on weekends, like after helping out his wife's restaurant. But now this is, he just got back to Norway. They just went free diving with orcas, and they got closer than anyone else on the planet, and they were able to record their click communication. And no one else has done this, and they were able to do it because, A, they know how to free dive free, or two, they're the only people insane enough to go up to Norway in winter and free dive in 7 mil wetsuits. and water that's around, you know, 31 degrees, and the air temperature was like 17. They showed me pictures. Their face is all covered in ice. So that's why. It's those, the combination of those two things, curiosity, persistence, and maybe insanity. So that is, in essence, it's really awoken a lot of people. To the ability with modern technology is so cheap right now. Everyone can get a GoPro. They're really trying to enlist a bunch of DIY people to go out there and record these click communications and collect them together. And then they'll process them at the University of Paris. So one more question right over here.
We had an opportunity last year. We snorkeled with whale sharks, which is just phenomenal. I mean, like our second snorkeling trip. But anyway, her career was ended. Something about her body responded kind of in the same sense that we have like a heart attack up here. I didn't really understand it at the time. Can you kind of respond to free divers who run into problems, ended their career?
Yeah, unfortunately, this is how a lot of competitive free divers stop. It's usually the only thing to get them to stop. They go too deep. They push against all of their body's instincts, and they end up getting seriously hurt. So that happens. I don't know about having a heart attack up there. I'm not sure exactly what that means. I know that people who just keep that – again, that's what makes competitive diving so dangerous. Like, you go as deep – a 75-year-old freediver told me this. He's been diving his whole life, holds his breath for 5 minutes, goes down 200 feet, no problems. He's a French guy. He was like, some days I go down 20 feet. Other days I go down 200 feet. Your body changes day to day. So when you have a competition set up in a week, you're going to go down to that depth no matter what. You're not going to listen to your body. So a lot of people get hurt in that way, and there's many ways. You can tear your larynx if you're not completely relaxed. You can have a lung squeeze where the lungs end up collapsing and you start coughing up blood. I mean, this is the ugliest, most gruesome stuff on the planet. You can die. They die. These no limits guys die. So what I found, it's sad, but a lot of competitors wait until something really bad happens and then they have this epiphany. But luckily, in the past couple years, I think the word is getting out. This kind of stuff is getting out right now that people, now a lot of competitive freedivers have given it up. A few, and I was very touched by this, after reading the book, they said, I'm not going to do this anymore. This is what I'm going to use it for, which is awesome. So yeah, hopefully she's okay now and doesn't have any. Do you know her name by any chance? Because it's a small world of them. It's a very small world. I might know her. Huh. Well, that's a good instructor to have snorkeling with whale sharks. Man, I'm jealous.
Yeah, she was in Cozumel. Whale sharks were off at Isla Mujeres.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, I wish I had that luck. So, very nicely done. All right, well, thank you, everyone, so much for coming out.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Foden. We have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.